towering over Tempest, who looked suddenly unnerved, while Jason shrank back in his seat, looking as though he wanted to disappear inside his hoodie.
"Come on, Corm," said Robin, ripping her card out of the machine.
"Just so you know," said Strike, addressing both Tempest and Jason, as Robin grabbed her coat and tried to pull him away from the table, "I was in a car that blew up around me."
Jason had put his hands over his scarlet face, his eyes full of tears. Tempest merely gaped.
"The driver was ripped in two." "That'd get you some attention, eh?" he said savagely to Tempest. "Only he was dead, so not so fucking much. The other guy lost half his face. I lost a leg. There was nothing voluntary about..."
"Okay," said Robin, taking Strike's arm. "We're off. Thanks very much for meeting us, Jason."
"Get some help,"
said Strike loudly, pointing at Jason as he allowed Robin to pull him away, diners and waiters staring.
"Get some fucking help with your head."
They were out in the leafy road, nearly a block away from the gallery, before Strike's breathing began to return to normal.
"Okay," he said, though Robin had not spoken. "You warned me. I'm sorry."
"That's all right," she said mildly. "We got everything we wanted." They walked on in silence for a few yards.
"Did you pay? I didn't notice."
"Yes. I'll take it out of petty cash." They walked on. Well-dressed men and women passed them, busy, bustling. A bohemian-looking girl with dreadlocks floated past in a long paisley dress. But a 500-pound handbag revealed that her hippie credentials were as fake as Tempest's disability.
"At least you didn't punch her," said Robin, "in her wheelchair, in front of all the art lovers."
Strike began to laugh. Robin shook her head.
"I knew you'd lose it," she sighed. But she was smiling.
Chapter 44. Then came the last days of May. He had thought she was dead. It had not troubled him that he hadn't seen a news report, because she'd been a hooker. He'd never seen anything in the papers about the first one he'd done either. Prostitutes didn't fucking count. They were nothing. No one cared. The secretary was the one who was going to make the big splash, because she was working for that bastard. A clean-living girl with her pretty fiancé, the kind the press went wild for. He didn't understand how the whore could still be alive, though. He remembered the feeling of her torso beneath the knife, the popping, puncturing sound of the metal slitting her skin, the grating of steel on bone, the blood gushing. Students had found her, according to the newspaper. Fucking students. He still had her fingers, though. She'd produced a photo fit. What a fucking joke. The police were shaven monkeys in uniforms, the lot of them. Did they think this picture would help? It looked nothing like him, nothing at all. It could have been anyone, white or black. He would have laughed out loud if it hadn't been there, but it wouldn't like him laughing over a dead hooker and a photo fit. It was pretty bolshy at the moment. He had had to work hard to make up for the fact that he had treated it roughly, had to apologize, play the nice guy. "I was upset," he had said, "really upset." He'd had to cuddle it and buy it fucking flowers and stay home to make up for being angry, and now it was taking advantage, the way women always did, trying to take more, as much as it could get.
"I don't like it when you go away. I'll make you fucking go away if you keep this up."
He had told her a cock and bull story about the chance of a job, but for the first time ever she actually fucking dared question him. "Who told you about it? How long will you be gone?" He watched it talking, and he imagined drawing back a fist and punching it so hard in its ugly face that the bones splintered. Yet he needed it a little while longer, at least until he did the secretary. It
still loved him. That was the trump card. He knew he could bring it back into line with the threat of leaving for good. He didn't want to overplay that one, though. So he pressed on with the flowers, the kisses, the kindness that made the memory of his raid soften and dissolve in its stupid, addled memory. He liked to add a little emollient to her drinks, a little extra something to keep her off balance, weeping into his neck, clinging to him. Patient, kind, but determined. At last, she agreed. A week away, completely away, free to do as he liked. Chapter 45. Harvester of Eyes, That's Me. Blue Oyster Cult, Harvester of Eyes. Detective Inspector Eric Wardle was far from delighted that Jason and Tempest had lied to his men. But Strike found him less angry than he might have expected when they met for a pint, at Wardle's invitation, on Monday evening in the Feathers. The explanation for his surprising forbearance was simple. The revelation that Kelsey had been picked up from her rendezvous in Café Rouge by a man on a motorbike fitted perfectly with Wardle's new pet theory. You remember the guy called Devotee was on their website? Got a fetish for amputees, went quiet after Kelsey was killed. Yeah, said Strike, who recalled Robin saying that she had had an interaction with him. We've tracked him down. Guess what's in his garage? Strike assumed, from the fact that no arrest had been made, that they had not found body parts, so he obligingly suggested, motorbike? Kawasaki Ninja, said Wardle. I know we're looking for a Honda, he added, forestalling Strike, but he crapped himself when we came calling. So do most people when CID turn up on their doorstep. Go on. He's a sweaty little guy named Baxter, a sales rep with no alibi for the weekend of the 2nd and 3rd, or for the 29th. Divorced, no kids. Claims he stayed in for the royal wedding, watching it. Would you have watched a royal wedding without a woman in the house? No, said Strike, who had only caught footage on the news. He claims the bike's his brother's and he's just looking after it. But after a bit of questioning, he admitted he's taken it out a few times. So we know he can ride one, and he could have hired or borrowed a Honda. What did he say about the website? He downplayed that completely. Says he's only pissing around, doesn't mean anything by it. He's not turned on by stumps. But when we asked whether we could have a look at his computer, he didn't like it at all. Asked to talk to his lawyer before he gave an answer. That's where we've left it. But we're going back to see him again tomorrow. Friendly chat. Did he admit to talking to Kelsey online? Hard for him to deny it when we've got her laptop and all Tempest's records. He asked Kelsey about her plans for her leg and offered to meet her and she brushed him off. Online, anyway. Bloody hell, we've got to look into him, said Wardle in response to Strike's sceptical look. He's got no alibi, a motorbike, a thing for amputation, and he tried to meet her. Yeah, of course, said Strike. Any other leads? That's why I wanted to meet you. We found your Donald Lang. He's in Wollaston Close in Elephant and Castle. He is? Said Strike, genuinely taken aback. Savouring the fact that he had surprised Strike for once, Wardle smirked. Yeah, and he's a sick man. We found him through a Just Giving page. We got onto them and got his address. That was the difference between Strike and Wardle, of course. The latter still had badges, authority, and the kind of power Strike had relinquished when he left the army. Have you seen him? Asked Strike. Sent a couple of guys round and he wasn't in, but the neighbours confirmed it's his flat. He rents, lives alone, and he's pretty ill, apparently. They said he's gone home to Scotland for a bit. Friend's funeral. Supposed to be back soon. Likely bloody story, muttered Strike into his pint. If Lang's got a friend left in Scotland, I'll eat this glass. Have it your own way, said Wardle, half amused, half impatient. I thought you'd be pleased with chasing up your guys. I am, said Strike. Definitely ill, is he? The neighbour reckons he needs sticks. He's been in and out of hospital a lot, apparently. The leather-padded screen overhead was showing last month's Arsenal-Liverpool match with the sound turned down. Strike watched as Van Persie sank the penalty that he had thought, watching back on his tiny portable at the flat, might help Arsenal to a desperately needed win. It hadn't happened, of course. The Gunners' fortunes were currently sinking with his own. "You seeing anyone?" asked Wardle abruptly.
"What?"
said Strike, startled.
"Coco liked the look of you," said Wardle, making sure that Strike saw him smirking as he said it, the better to impress upon Strike that he thought this ludicrous.
"The wife's friend, Coco, red hair, remember?"
Strike remembered that Coco was a burlesque dancer.
"I said I'd ask," said Wardle. "I've told her you're a miserable bastard. She says she doesn't mind."
"Tell her I'm flattered," said Strike, which was the truth. "But yeah, I'm seeing someone."
"Not your work partner, is it?" asked Wardle.
"No," said Strike. "She's getting married."
"You missed a trick there, mate,"
said Wardle, yawning.
"I would."
"So let me get this straight," said Robin in the office next morning. "As soon as we find out that Lang actually does live in Woolaston Close, you want me to stop watching it?"
"Hear me out," said Strike, who was making tea. "He's away, according to the neighbours."
"You've just told me you don't think he's really gone to Scotland. The fact that a door of his flat's been closed ever since you've been watching it suggests he's gone somewhere."
Strike dropped tea bags into two mugs.
"I don't buy the friend's funeral bit, but it wouldn't surprise me if he popped back to Melrose to try and beat some cash out of his demented mother. That could easily be our Donnie's idea of holiday fun."
"One of us should be there for when he comes back."
"One of us will be there," said Strike soothingly. "But in the meantime, I want you to switch to
Brockbank."
"No, I'm doing Brockbank," said Strike. "I want you to have a bash at Stephanie."
"Who?"
"Stephanie, Whittaker's girl."
"Why?"
asked Robin loudly, as the kettle boiled in its usual crescendo of rattling lid and rambunctious bubbles, condensation steaming up the window behind it.
"I want to see whether she can tell us what Whittaker was doing the day Kelsey was killed, and on the night that girl got her fingers hacked off in Shacklewell. The 3rd and the 29th of April, to be precise."
Strike poured water on the tea bags and stirred in milk, the teaspoon pinging off the sides of the mug. Robin was not sure whether she was pleased or aggrieved by the suggested change to her routine. On balance, she thought she was glad, but her recent suspicions that Strike was trying to sideline her were not easily dispelled.
"You definitely still think Whittaker could be the killer?"
"Yep," said Strike.
"But you haven't got any..."
"I haven't got any evidence for any of them, have I?" said Strike. "I'm just going to keep going until I either get some or clear all of them."
He handed her a mug of tea and sank down on a mock leather sofa, which for once did not fart beneath him. A minor triumph, but in the absence of others, better than nothing.
"I hoped I'd be able to rule out Whittaker on how he's looking these days," said Strike. "But, you know, it could have been him in that beanie hat. I know one thing. He's exactly the same bastard he was when I knew him. I've blown it completely with Stephanie. She's not going to talk to me now, but you might be able to do something with her. If she can give him an alibi for those days, or point us towards someone else who can, we'll have to rethink. If not, he stays on the list."
"And what are you going to be doing while I'm on Stephanie?"
"Sticking with Brockbank, I've decided," said Strike, stretching out his legs and taking a fortifying drink of tea. "I'm going into the strip club today, find out what's happened to him. I'm tired of eating kebabs and hanging round clothes shops waiting for him to show up."
Robin did not say anything.
"What?"
said Strike, watching her expression.
"Nothing."
"Come off it."
"Okay. What if he is there?"
"I'll cross that bridge. I'm not going to hit him," said Strike, correctly reading her thoughts.
"Okay," said Robin,
But then, you hit Whittaker, though.
That was different, said Strike.
And when she did not respond,
Whittaker's special. He's family.
She laughed, but reluctantly. When Strike withdrew £50 from a cash point prior to entering the Saracen off Commercial Road, the machine churlishly showed him a negative balance in his current account. His expression grim, Strike handed over a tenner to the short-necked bouncer on the door and pushed his way through the strips of black plastic masking the interior, which was dimly lit, but insufficiently to mask the overall impression of shabbiness. The interior of the old pub had been ripped out in its entirety. The refashioned decor gave the impression of a community centre gone bad, dimly lit and soulless. The floor was of polished pine, which reflected the wide neon strip running the length of the bar that took up one side of the room. It was shortly after midday, but there was already a girl gyrating on a small stage at the far end of the pub. Bathed in red light and standing in front of angled mirrors so that every inch of dimpled flesh could be appreciated, she was removing her bra to the Rolling Stones' Start Me Up. A grand total of four men were sitting on high stools, one to each elevated table, dividing their attention between the girl now swinging clumsily around a pole and a big-screen TV showing Sky Sports. Strike headed straight for the bar, where he found himself facing a sign that read, "Any customer caught masturbating will be ejected."
"What can I get you, love?"
asked a girl with long hair, purple eyeshadow, and a nose ring. Strike ordered a pint of John Smith's and took a seat at the bar. Other than the bouncer, the only other male employee on view was the man sitting behind a turntable beside the stripper. He was stocky, blonde, middle-aged, and did not remotely resemble Brockbank.
"I was hoping to meet a friend here," Strike told the barmaid,
who, having no further customers, was leaning on the bar, staring dreamily at the television and picking her long nails.
"Yeah,"
she said, sounding bored.
"Yeah," said Strike. "He said he was working here."
A man in a fluorescent jacket approached the bar, and she moved away to serve him without another word. Start Me Up ended, and so did the stripper's act. Naked, she hopped off the stage, grabbed a wrap and disappeared through a curtain at the back of the pub. Nobody clapped. A woman in a very short nylon kimono and stockings slid out from behind the curtain and began walking around the pub, holding out an empty beer glass to punters, who one by one put their hands in their pockets and gave her some change. She reached Strike last. He dropped in a couple of quid. She headed straight for the stage, where she put her pint glass of coins carefully beside the DJ's turntable, wriggled out of her kimono, and stepped onto the stage in bra, pants, stockings and heels.
"Gentlemen, I think you're going to enjoy this. Big welcome, please, for the lovely Mia!"
She began to jiggle to Gary Newman's Our Friends Electric. There was not the remotest synchronicity between her movements and the track. The barmaid resumed her lounging position near Strike. The view of the TV was clearest from where he sat.
"Yeah, like I was saying," Strike began again. "A friend of mine told me he's working here."
"Mm-hmm,"
she said.
"Name of Noel Brockbank."
"Yeah, I don't know him."
"No," said Strike, making a show of scanning the place, although he had already established that Brockbank was nowhere to be seen. "Maybe I've got the wrong place."
The first stripper pushed her way out from behind the curtain, having changed into a bubblegum pink spaghetti-strap mini-dress that barely skimmed her crotch and was somehow more indecent than her previous nakedness. She approached the man in the fluorescent jacket and asked him something, but he shook his head. Looking around, she caught Strike's eye, smiled, and approached him.
"Hiya,"
she said. Her accent was Irish. Her hair, which she had thought blonde in the red light of the stage, turned out to be vivid copper. Beneath the thick orange lipstick and the thick false eyelashes hid a girl who looked as though she should still have been at school.
"I'm Orla. Who are you?"
"Cameron," said Strike, which was what people usually called him after failing to grasp his first name.
"Do you fancy a private dance then, Cameron?"
"Where does that happen?"
"Through there,"
she said, pointing towards the curtain where she had changed.
"I've never seen you in here before."
"No, I'm looking for a friend."
"What's her name?"
"It's a him." "You've come to the wrong place for hims, darling," she said. She was so young he felt mildly dirty just hearing her call him darling. "Can I buy you a drink?" Strike asked. She hesitated. There was more money in a private dance, but perhaps he was the kind of guy who needed warming up first.
"Go on, then."
Strike paid an exorbitant amount for a vodka and lime, which she sipped primly on a seat beside him, most of her breasts hanging out of the dress. The texture of her skin reminded him of the murdered Kelsey, smooth and firm, with plenty of youthful fat. There were three small blue stars inked on her shoulder.
"Maybe you know my friend," Strike said. "Noel Brockbank."
She was no fool, little Orla. Suspicion and calculation mingled in the sharp sideways look she gave him. She was wondering, like the masseurs back in Market Harborough, whether he was police.
"He owes me money," said Strike.
She continued to scrutinize him for a moment, her smooth forehead furrowed, then apparently swallowed the lie.
"Noel," she repeated, "I think he's gone. Hang on. Edie!"
The bored barmaid did not take her eyes from the TV.
"Hmm? What was the name of your man that Des sacked the other week? Guy who only lasted a few days?"
"Dunno what he was called."
"Yeah, I think it was Noel who was sacked," Orla told Strike. Then, with a sudden and endearing bluntness, she said, "Give me a tenner and I'll make sure for you."
With a mental sigh, Strike handed over a note.
"Wait there now," said Orla cheerfully.
She slipped off her bar stool, tucked the tenner into the elastic of her pants, tugged her dress down inelegantly, and sauntered over to the DJ, who scowled over at Strike while Orla spoke to him. He nodded curtly, his jowly face glowing in the red light, and Orla came trotting back looking pleased with herself.
"I thought so," she told Strike. "I wasn't here when it happened, but he had a fit or something."
"A fit?" repeated Strike.
"Yeah, it was only his first week on the job. Big guy, wasn't he, with the big chin?"
"That's right," said Strike.
"Yeah, and he was late, and Des wasn't happy. That's Des over there," she added unnecessarily, pointing out the DJ who was watching Strike suspiciously while changing the track from Our Friends Electric to Cyndi Lauper's Girls Just Wanna Have Fun. "Des was given out to him about being late, and your man just dropped to the floor and started riding around. They say," added Orla with relish, "he pissed himself."
Strike doubted that Brockbank would have urinated over himself to escape a dressing down from Des. It sounded as though he had genuinely had an epileptic fit.
"Then what happened?"
"Your mate's girlfriend come running out the back."
"What girlfriend's this?"
"Hang on. Edie!"
"Hmm?
Who's that black girl now with the extensions? The one with the great knockers? The one Des doesn't like?"
"Elisa," said Edie.
"Elisa," Orla told Strike. "She come running out the back and was screaming at Des to phone an ambulance."
"Did he?"
"Yeah. They took your man away and Elisa went with him."
"And has Noel been back since?"
"He's no bloody use as a bouncer if he's going to fall down and piss himself just because someone's shouting at him, is he?" said Orla. "I heard Elisa wanted Des to give him a second chance, but Des doesn't give second chances."
"So Elisa called Des a tight cunt,"
said Edie, emerging suddenly from her listlessness.
"And he sacked her too, silly bitch. She needs the money. She's got kids."
"When did all this happen?" Strike asked Orla and Edie.
A couple of weeks ago, said Edie. But he was a creep, that guy. Good riddance.
In what way was he a creep? Asked Strike.
You can always tell, said Edie,
with a kind of hard-bitten weariness.
Always. Elisa's got fucking terrible taste in men.
The second stripper was now down to her thong and twerking enthusiastically towards her scanty audience. Two older men had just entered the club and hesitated before approaching the bar, their eyes on the thong, which was clearly about to come off.
You don't know where I'd find Noel, do you? Strike asked Edie,
who seemed too bored to demand money for the information.
He's living with Elisa somewhere in Bow, said the barmaid. She got herself a council house, but she was always bitching about the place. I don't know exactly where it is, she said, forestalling Strike's question. I never went round or nothing.
I thought she liked it, said Orla vaguely. She said there was a good nursery.
The stripper had wriggled out of her thong and was waving it over her head, lasso style. Having seen all there was to see, the two new punters drifted to the bar. One of them, a man old enough to be Orla's grandfather, fixed his roomy eyes on her cleavage. She sized him up, businesslike, then turned to Strike.
So, you want a private dance or not?
I don't think I will, said Strike.
Before the words were even fully out of his mouth, she had put down her glass, wriggled off the chair, and slid towards the 60-year-old who grinned, revealing more gaps than teeth. A hulking figure appeared at Strike's side, the necklace bouncer.
Des wants a word, he said,
in what would have been a menacing tone had his voice not been surprisingly high-pitched for a man so broad. Strike looked around. The DJ, who was glaring across the room at him, beckoned.
Is there a problem? Strike asked the bouncer.
Des will tell you if there is,
was the faintly ominous answer. So Strike crossed the room to speak to the DJ and stood like a massive schoolboy summoned to the headmaster at his lectern. Fully alive to the absurdity of the situation, he had to wait while a third stripper deposited her glass of coins safely beside the turntable, wriggled out of her purple robe, and ascended the stage in black lace and perspex heels. She was heavily tattooed and, beneath thick makeup, spotty.
"Gentlemen, tits, arse and class from Jacqueline!"
Africa by Toto began. Jacqueline began to spin around the pole, at which she was far more accomplished than either of her colleagues, and Des covered the microphone with his hand and leaned forwards.
"Right, pal."
He appeared both older and harder than he had in the red light of the stage, his eyes shrewd, a scar as deep as Shanker's running along his jaw.
"What are you asking about that bouncer for?" "He's a friend of mine. He never had a contract. I never said he had. Unfair dismissal, my fucking arse. He never told me he had fucking fits.
Have you been sent here by that Elisa bitch?"
"No," said Strike. "I was told Noel worked here. She's a mad fucking cow. I wouldn't know. It's him I'm looking for."
Scratching an armpit, Des glowered at Strike, while, 4 feet away, Jacqueline slipped her bra straps from her shoulders and glared over her shoulder at the half-dozen punters watching.
"Bollocks was that bastard ever in the Special Forces," said Des aggressively, as though Strike had insisted he had been. "Is that what he told you?" "It's what she said, Elisa. They wouldn't take a fucking wreck like that. Anyway," said Des, eyes narrowed, "there was other stuff I didn't like." "Yeah? Like what?" "That's my business. You tell her that from me. It wasn't just his fucking fit. You tell her to ask Mia why I didn't want him back. And you tell Elisa, if she does one more stupid fucking thing to my car, or sends one more of her friends round trying to get something on me, I'll fucking have her in court. You tell her that."
Fair enough, said Strike. Got an address?
Fuck off, all right,
snarled Des.
Fuck off out of here.
He leaned into the microphone.
Nice, he said, with a kind of professional leer, as Jacqueline jiggled her breasts rhythmically in the scarlet light.
Des made a hoppic gesture to Strike and returned to his stack of old vinyl records. Accepting the inevitable, Strike allowed himself to be escorted to the door. Nobody paid any attention. The audience's attention remained divided between Jacqueline and Lionel Messi on the widescreen TV. At the door, Strike stood aside for a group of young men in suits to enter, all of whom seemed already a little worse for drink.
Tits!
Yelled the first of them, pointing at the stripper.
Tits!
The bouncer took exception to this mode of entry. A mild altercation ensued, with the shouter cowed by his friends and the bouncer's strictures, which were delivered with several jabs of a forefinger to his chest. Strike waited patiently for the matter to be adjusted. When the young men had finally been allowed to enter, he took his departure to the opening strains of The Only Way Is Up by Yaz. Chapter 46. Subhuman. Alone with his trophies, he felt himself entirely whole. They were proof of his superiority, his astonishing ability to glide through the ape-like police and sheep-like masses, taking whatever he wanted, like a demigod. Of course, they gave him something else, too. He never seemed to get hard when he was actually killing. Thinking about it beforehand, yes. Sometimes he could drive himself into an onanistic frenzy with ideas of what he was going to do, refining and restaging the possibilities in his mind. Afterwards, now, for instance, holding in his hand the chilly, rubbery, shrunken breast he had hacked from Kelsey's torso, already turning slightly leathery with its repeated exposure to the air outside the fridge. Then he had no problem at all. He was like a flagpole now. He had the new one's fingers in the icebox. He took one out, pressed it against his lips, then bit down on it hard. He imagined her still connected to it, screaming in agony. He chewed deeper, relishing the feeling of the cold flesh splitting, his teeth pressing hard into the bone. One hand fumbled with the string of his tracksuit bottoms. Afterwards, he put it all back in the fridge, closed the door, and gave it a little pat, grinning to himself. There'd be a lot more than that in there soon. The secretary wasn't small, 5'7" or 5'8" by his reckoning. One minor problem. He didn't know where she was. He'd lost the trail. She hadn't been to the office this morning. He'd gone to the LSE, where he'd spotted the platinum bitch, but seen no sign of the secretary. He'd looked in the court, he'd even checked the Tottenham. This was a temporary setback, though. He'd sniff her out. He'd pick her up again tomorrow morning at West Ealing Station, if he had to. He made himself a coffee and poured a slug of whiskey into it from a bottle he'd had here for months. There was hardly anything else in the dirty hidey hole where he hid his treasures, in his secret sanctuary. A kettle, a few chipped mugs, the fridge, the altar of his profession. An old mattress to sleep on, and a docking port for him to place his iPod on. That was important. It had become part of his ritual. He had thought they were shit when he'd first heard them. But as his obsession with bringing down Strike had grown, so had his liking for their music. He liked to listen to it through earphones while he was stalking the secretary, while he was cleaning his knives. It was sacred music to him now. Some of their lyrics stayed with him like fragments of a religious service. The more he listened, the more he felt they understood. Women were reduced to the elemental when they were facing the knife.
they became cleansed by their terror. There was a kind of purity to them as they begged and pleaded for their lives. The cult, as he privately called them, seemed to understand. They got it. He put his iPod into the dock and selected one of his favourite tracks, Dr. Music. Then he headed to the sink and the cracked shaving mirror he kept there, razor and scissors at the ready. All the tools a man needed to totally transform himself. From the single speaker of the dock, Eric Bloom sang, "Girl, don't stop that screaming. You're sounding so sincere." Chapter 47. I sense the darkness clearer. Blue Oyster Cult, Harvest Moon. Today, June the 1st, Robin was able to say for the first time, "I'm getting married next month." July the 2nd suddenly seemed very close. The dressmaker back in Harrogate wanted a final fitting, but she had no idea when she would be able to fit in a trip home. At least she had her shoes. Her mother was taking the RSVPs and updating her regularly on the guest list. Robin felt strangely disconnected from it all. A tedious hours of surveillance in Catford Broadway, staking out the flat over the chip shop, were a world away from queries on the flowers, who should sit beside whom at the reception, and, this last from Matthew, whether or not she had yet asked Strike for the fortnight off for the honeymoon, which Matthew had booked, and which was to be a surprise. She did not know how the wedding could have come so close without her realizing. Next month, the very next month, she would become Robin Cunliffe. At least, she supposed she would. Matthew certainly expected her to take his name. He was incredibly cheerful these days, hugging her wordlessly when he passed her in the hall, raising not a single objection to the long hours she was working, hours that bled into their weekends. He had driven her to Catford in the last few mornings, because it was on the way to the company he was auditing in Bromley. He was being nice about the despised Land Rover now, even while he crashed the gears and stalled it at junctions, saying what a wonderful gift it had been, how kind Linda was to have given it to them, how useful a car was when he was sent somewhere out of town. During yesterday's commute, he had offered to remove Sarah Shadlock from the wedding guest list. Robin could tell that he had had to screw up his courage even to ask the question, afraid that mentioning Sarah's name might provoke a row. She had thought about it for a while, wondering how she really felt, and finally said no. "I don't mind," she said. "I'd rather she came. It's fine." Removing Sarah from the list would tell Sarah that Robin had found out what had happened years before. She would rather pretend that she had always known, that Matthew had confessed long ago, that it was nothing to her. She had her pride. However, when her mother, who had also queried Sarah's attendance, asked whom Robin wanted to put on Sarah's free side, now that Sarah and Matthew's mutual university friend Sean couldn't make it, Robin answered with a question. "Has Cormoran RSVP'd?"
"No," said her mother.
"Oh," said Robin. "Well, he says he's going to."
"You want to put him next to Sarah, do you?"
"No, of course not," snapped Robin. There was a short pause.
"Sorry," said Robin. "Sorry, Mum, stressed. No, could you sit Cormoran next to... I don't know. Is his girlfriend coming?"
"He says not.
Put him anywhere. Just not near bloody... I mean, not by Sarah."
So, Robin settled in to wait for a glimpse of Stephanie on the warmest morning so far. The shoppers on Catford Broadway were wearing T-shirts and sandals. Black women passed in brightly coloured head wraps. Robin, who had put on a sundress under an old denim jacket, leaned back into one of her accustomed nooks in the theatre building, pretending that she was talking on the mobile and killing time before she pretended to peruse the scented candles and incense sticks on the nearest stall.
It was difficult to maintain concentration when you were convinced that you had been sent on a wild goose chase. Strike might insist that he still thought Whittaker a suspect in Kelsey's killing, but Robin was quietly unconvinced. She increasingly inclined to Wardle's view that Strike had it in for his ex-stepfather, and that his usually sound judgment was clouded by old grievances. Glancing up periodically at the unmoving curtains of Whittaker's flat, she remembered that Stephanie had last been seen being bundled into the back of a transit van by Whittaker, and wondered whether she was even inside the flat. From faint resentment that this was going to be another wasted day, she fell easily to dwelling on the main grudge she currently felt against Strike: his appropriation of the search for Noel Brockbank. Somehow, Robin had come to feel that Brockbank was particularly her own suspect. Had she not successfully impersonated Venetia Hall, they would never have known that Brockbank was living in London, and if she had not the wit to recognize that Niall was Noel, they would never have traced him to the Saracen. Even the low voice in her ear, "Do I know you, little girl?" creepy as it had been, constituted a strange kind of connection. The mingled smells of raw fish and incense that had come to represent Whittaker and Stephanie filled her nostrils as she leaned back against chilly stone and watched the unmoving door of his flat. Like foxes to a dustbin, her unruly thoughts slunk back to Zahara, the little girl who had answered Brockbank's mobile. Robin had thought of her every day since they had spoken, and had asked Strike for every detail about the little girl's mother on his return from the strip club. He had told Robin that Brockbank's girlfriend was called Elisa, and that she was black, so Zahara must be too. Perhaps she looked like the little girl with stiff pigtails now waddling along the street, holding tight to her mother's forefinger and staring at Robin with solemn dark eyes. Robin smiled, but the little girl did not. She merely continued to scrutinize Robin as she and her mother passed. Robin kept smiling until the little girl, twisting almost 180 degrees so as not to break eye contact with Robin, tripped over her tiny sandaled feet. She hit the ground and began to wail. Her impassive mother scooped her up and carried her. Feeling guilty, Robin resumed her observation of Whittaker's windows as the fallen toddler's wails reverberated down the street. Zahara almost certainly lived in the flat in Bow that Strike had told her about. Zahara's mother complained about the flat, apparently, although Strike said that one of the girls had said... "Of course," Robin muttered excitedly. "Of course." Strike wouldn't have thought of that. Of course he wouldn't. He was a man. She began to press the keys on her phone. There were 7 nurseries in Bow. Absently placing her mobile in her pocket and energized by her train of thought, Robin began her usual drift through the market stalls, casting the occasional glance up at the windows of Whittaker's flat and at the perennially closed door, her mind entirely given over to the pursuit of Brockbank. She could think of 2 possible courses of action. Stake out each of these 7 nurseries, watching for a black woman picking up a girl called Sahara. And how would she know which was the right mother and daughter? Or... She paused beside a stall selling ethnic jewellery, barely seeing it, preoccupied by thoughts of Sahara. Entirely by chance, she looked up from a pair of feather and bead earrings, as Stephanie, whom Strike had accurately described, came out of the door beside the chip shop. Pale, red-eyed and blinking in the bright light like an albino rabbit, Stephanie leaned on the chip shop door, toppled inside, and proceeded to the counter. Before Robin could collect her wits, Stephanie had brushed past her holding a can of Coke and gone back into the building through the white door. Shit. "Nothing," she told Strike on the phone an hour later. "She's still in there. I didn't have a chance to do anything. She was in and out in about 3 minutes.
"Stick with it," said Strike. "She might come out again. At least we know she's awake."
"Any luck with Lang?"
Not while I was there, but I have had to come back to the office. Big news. Two times has forgiven me. He's just left. We need the money. I could hardly refuse.
Oh, for God's sake. How can he have another girlfriend already? Asked Robin.
He hasn't. He wants me to check out some new lap dancer he's flirting with. See whether she's already in a relationship.
Why doesn't he just ask her?
He has. She says she isn't seeing anyone, but women are devious, cheating scum, Robin. You know that.
Oh, yes, of course, sighed Robin. I forgot. Listen, I've had an idea about Wait. Something's happening.
Everything all right? He asked sharply.
Fine. Hang on.
A transit van had rolled up in front of her. Keeping the mobile to her ear, Robin ambled around it, trying to see what was going on. As far as she could make out, the driver had a crew cut, but the sun on the windscreen dazzled her eyes, obscuring his features. Stephanie had appeared on the pavement. Arms wrapped tightly around herself, she trooped across the street and climbed into the back of the van. Robin stepped back to allow it to pass, pretending to talk into her mobile. Her eyes met those of the driver. They were dark and hooded.
She's gone. Got in the back of an old van, she told Strike. The driver didn't look like Whittaker. Could have been mixed race or Mediterranean. Hard to see.
Well, we know Stephanie's on the game. She's probably off to earn Whittaker some money.
Robin tried not to resent his matter-of-fact tone. He had, she reminded herself, freed Stephanie from Whittaker's stranglehold with a punch to the gut. She paused, looking into a newsagent's window. Royal wedding ephemera was still very much in evidence. A Union Jack was hanging on the wall behind the Asian man at the till.
What do you want me to do?
I could go and cover Wollaston Close for you if you're after two times his new girl. It makes...
Off!
She gasped. She had turned to walk away and collided with a tall man sporting a goatee who swore at her.
Sorry,
she gasped automatically as the man shoved his way past her into the newsagents.
What just happened? Asked Strike.
Nothing. I bumped into someone. Listen, I'm going to go to Wollaston Close, she said.
All right, said Strike, after a perceptible pause. But if Lang turns up, just try and get a picture. Don't go anywhere near him.
I wasn't intending to, said Robin.
Call me if there's any news, or even if there isn't.
The brief spurt of enthusiasm she had felt at the prospect of going back to Wollaston Close had faded by the time she had reached Catford Station. She was not sure why she felt suddenly downcast and anxious. Perhaps she was hungry. Determined to break herself of the chocolate habit that was jeopardizing her ability to fit into the altered wedding dress, she bought herself an unappetizing-looking energy bar before boarding the train. Chewing the sawdusty slab as the train carried her towards Elephant and Castle, she found herself absent-mindedly rubbing her ribs where she had collided with a large man in the goatee. Being sworn at by random people was the price you paid for living in London, of course. She could not ever remember a stranger swearing at her in Masson, not even once. Something made her suddenly look all around her. But there did not seem to be any large man in her vicinity, neither in the sparsely occupied carriage, nor peering at her from the neighbouring ones. Now she came to think of it, she had jettisoned some of her habitual vigilance that morning, lulled by the familiarity of Catford Broadway, distracted by her thoughts of Brockbank and Sahara. She wondered whether she would have noticed somebody else there, watching her. But that surely was paranoia. Matthew had dropped her off in a Land Rover that morning. How could the killer have followed her to Catford unless he had been waiting in some kind of vehicle at Hastings Road? Nevertheless, she thought, she must guard against complacency. When she got off the train, she noticed a tall, dark man walking a little behind her and deliberately stopped to let him pass. He did not give her a second look. I'm definitely being paranoid, she thought, dropping the unfinished energy bar into a bin. It was 1:30 before she reached the forecourt of Wollaston Close, the strata building looming over the shabby old flats like an emissary from the future. The long sundress and the old denim jacket that had fitted in so well in the market in Catford felt a little studentish here. Yet again pretending to be on her mobile, Robin looked casually upwards and her heart gave a little skip. Something had changed. The curtains had been pulled back. Hyper-aware now, she maintained her course in case he was looking out of the window, intending to find a place in shadow where she could keep an eye on his balcony. So intent was she on finding the perfect place to lurk and on maintaining the appearance of a natural conversation that she had no attention to spare for where she was treading.
No!
Robin squealed as her right foot skidded out from under her. Her left became caught in the hem of her long skirt and she slid into an undignified half-splits before toppling sideways and dropping her mobile.
Oh, bugger,
she moaned. Whatever she had slipped in looked like vomit or even diarrhea. Some was clinging to her dress, to her sandal, and she had grazed her hand on landing. But it was the precise identity of the thick, yellow-brown, glutinous, lumpy stuff that worried her most. Somewhere in her vicinity, a man burst out laughing. Cross and humiliated, she tried to get up without spreading the muck further over her clothes and shoes, and did not look immediately for the source of the jeering noise.
"Sorry, hen," said a soft Scottish voice right behind her.
She looked around sharply, and several volts of electricity seemed to pass through her. In spite of the warmth of the day, he was wearing a windstopper hat with long ear flaps, a red and black check jacket, and jeans. A pair of metal crutches supported most of his substantial weight as he looked down at her, still grinning. Deep pockmarks disfigured his pale cheeks, his chin, and the pouches beneath his small dark eyes. The flesh on his thick neck spilled over his collar. A plastic bag containing what looked like a few groceries hung from one hand. She could just see the tattooed dagger tip that she knew ran through a yellow rose higher on his forearm. The drops of tattooed blood running down his wrist looked like injuries.
"You'll need a tarp," he said, grinning broadly as he pointed at her foot and the hem of her dress. "And a scrubbing brush."
"Yes," said Robin shakily. She bent to pick up her mobile. The screen was cracked.
"I'll live up there," he said,
nodding towards the flat she had been watching on and off for a month.
"You can come up if you want. Clean yourself up."
"Oh no, that's all right. Thanks very much, though," said Robin breathlessly.
"Nae problem," said Donald Lang.
His gaze slithered down her body. Her skin prickled as though he had run a finger down her. Turning on his crutches, he began to move away, the plastic bag swinging awkwardly. Robin stood where he had left her, conscious of the blood pounding in her face. He did not look back. The ear flaps of his hat swayed like spaniel's ears as he moved painfully slowly around the side of the flats and out of sight.
"Oh my God," whispered Robin.
Hand and knee smarting where she had fallen, she absent-mindedly pushed her hair out of her face. Only then did she realize with relief from the smell on her fingers that the slippery substance had been curry. Hurrying to a corner, out of sight of Donald Lang's windows, she pressed the keys of the cracked mobile and called Strike. Chapter 48. Here comes that feeling. The heat wave that had descended on London was his enemy. There was nowhere to hide his knives in a t-shirt, and the hats and high collars on which he relied for disguise looked out of place. He could do nothing but wait, fuming and impotent, in the place that it did not know about. At last, on Sunday, the weather broke. Rain swept the parched parks, windscreen wipers danced, tourists donned their plastic ponchos and trudged on through the puddles regardless. Full of excitement and determination, he pulled on a hat worn low over his eyes and donned his special jacket. As he walked, the knives bounced against his chest in the long makeshift pockets he'd ripped in the lining. The capital streets were hardly less crowded now than when he'd knifed the tart whose fingers sat in his icebox. Tourists and Londoners were still swarming everywhere like ants. Some of them had bought Union Jack umbrellas and hats. He barged into some of them for the simple pleasure of knocking them aside. His need to kill was becoming urgent. The last few wasted days had slid past, his leave of absence from it slowly expiring. But the secretary remained alive and free. He had searched for hours trying to trace her, and then, shockingly, she had been right there in front of him, the brazen bitch, in broad daylight. But there had been witnesses everywhere. Poor impulse control, that fucking psychiatrist would have said, knowing what he'd done at the sight of her. Poor impulse control. He could control his impulses fine when he wanted. He was a man of superhuman cleverness, who had killed three women and maimed another without the police being any the wiser. So fuck the psychiatrist and his dumb diagnoses. But when he'd seen her right in front of him after all those empty days, he'd wanted to scare her, wanted to get up close, really close. Close enough to smell her, speak to her, look into her frightened eyes. Then she'd strutted away, and he had not dared follow her, not then. But it had almost killed him to let her go. She ought to be lying in parcels of meat in his fridge by now. He ought to have witnessed her face in that ecstasy of terror and death when he owned them completely, and they were his to play with. So here he was, walking through the chilly rain, burning inside because it was Sunday, and she had gone again, back to the place where he could never get near her, because Pretty Boy was always there. He needed more freedom, a lot more freedom. The real obstacle was having it at home all the time, spying on him, clinging to him. All that would have to change. He'd already pushed it unwillingly back into work. Now he had decided that he would have to pretend to it that he had a new job. If necessary, he'd steal to get cash, pretend he'd earned it. He'd done that plenty of times before. Then, freed up, he'd be able to put in the time he really needed to make sure he was close at hand when the secretary dropped her guard, when nobody was looking, when she turned the wrong corner. The passers-by had as little life as automata to him. Stupid, stupid, stupid. Everywhere he walked, he looked for her. The one he'd do next. Not the secretary, no, because the bitch was back behind her white front door with Pretty Boy. But any woman stupid enough, drunk enough, to walk a short way with a man and his knives. He had to do one before he went back to it. He had to. It would be all that could keep him going once he was back pretending to be the man it loved. His eyes flickered from under his hat, sorting them, discarding them. The women with men, the women with kids clutching them, but no women alone, none the way he needed them. He walked for miles until darkness fell, past lit pubs where men and women laughed and flirted, past restaurants and cinemas, looking, waiting, with a hunter's patience. Sunday night, and the workers were returning home early. But it did not matter. There were still tourists everywhere, out-of-towners drawn by the history and mystery of London. It was nearly midnight when they leapt to his practiced eye, like a cluster of plump mushrooms in long grass. A bunch of squawking, tiddly girls cackling and weaving along the pavement. They were on one of those miserable run-down streets that were his especial delight,
where a drunken tussle and a shrieking girl would be nothing out of the ordinary. He followed 10 yards behind them, watching them pass under street lamps